Welcome, everyone, to Wednesday's edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host today. We've got a really full show today. A lot of exciting stuff going to be happening today. Lots of folks going to be in and out of the studio. We've got rain developing for today, and then rain and snow developing a little bit later. Snow accumulation could be up to 2 inches tonight. Highs around 36 degrees for today. Then tonight, however, it's going to turn back into rain, heavy at times, rain mixing with snow, and a snow accumulation up to 2 inches, especially in the Mendenhall Valley, with lows right around 32 degrees tonight. For tomorrow, more rain in the forecast, and that's what's happening in the foreseeable future. Rain mixed with a little bit of snow. Well, as I said, lots of folks coming in and out of the studio today, including Dr. Quigley Peterson, an emergency physician from the hospital. He'll be here, as well as Sandy Kelly, who's an EMS training officer with Capital City Fire and Rescue, and we're going to get flu shots here as well from them. Both Jeff Brown and myself will be getting flu shots. I'm excited about it. I promise not to faint. We're also going to be hearing from Laura Haywood and Tom Loker. They're going to be doing a Juno Cabaret and going to be telling us all about that. The NOAA Observer Program is having an outreach meeting tomorrow night, and Julie Spiegel and Glenn Merrill will be here from NOAA to let us know about that. And also the folks from Eagle Crest will be here to tell us about the conditions up at the Hill and the special programs going on there. Special programming note for today on KTOO, Governor Parnell's State of the State speech will begin at 7 o'clock with special coverage from the KTOO newsroom. That'll be happening at 7 o'clock, the State of the State speech. Now here's National Native News.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders have called for a National Day of Action across Canada. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
This is how we unite our communities together. And we need your help, Canada. This involves each and every one of you.
There's been no let-up in the demonstrations across the country. They protested when some chiefs met with the Prime Minister last Friday, and the day after, and the day after that. Some Aboriginal people were among protesters arrested yesterday in British Columbia when they disrupted hearings for a proposed pipeline that would carry oil from Alberta to the BC coast and then on to Asian markets by tanker. Today, leaders have called for a concerted day of action with marches, rallies, protests, prayer circles, flash mobs, and even blockades of roads, rail lines, bridges, and border crossings. Many, such as Derek Nepinak, the head of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, say First Nations people are not going to be strung along by the government any longer.
We have said enough is enough. We're not going to stand for that anymore. We're the Indigenous people, and that's where the power is coming from.
Others, such as the Ontario Region Grand Chief Stan Beardy, says the Idle No More movement is becoming more militant.
I think it's best that the Canadian society works with us, that the Canadian government begin to work with us, because all of us have the same objective, and that is we all want good life, we want hope for the future, and we want the best for all our children.
Most chiefs were not satisfied with last week's response to their concerns from the Prime Minister, an offer of more high-level talks on land claims and treaties. They have asked repeatedly for better Native education, clean drinking water on reserves, and improved health care for their people. And they all want to share in Canada's natural resources, particularly those on Native lands. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The president of the Oglala Sioux tribe is returning to work after being involved in a serious auto accident. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The president of Southwest South Dakota's Oglala Sioux tribe, Brian Brewer, suffered several broken bones in the December 29th accident. Doctors kept him in the hospital until earlier this week, but have told him he would still need to come back for work on his broken hip. Brewer won the OST's presidency in his first attempt at tribal office, defeating incumbent John Yellowbird Steele. Brewer is known across the region as a Vietnam veteran and educator. He's also a major player in the annual Lakota Nation Invitational in Rapid City. That event features a basketball tournament among mostly tribal high schools, along with wrestling, hand games, art projects, and a knowledge bowl. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
An unfinished museum focused on Oklahoma tribes could get another chance from the state legislature. KGOU's Kurt Gourney reports.
Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon continues to support completion of the partially constructed American Indian Cultural Center and Museum in Oklahoma City. The project was mothballed last year when it ran out of money. The Oklahoma legislature failed to pass a bond proposal in 2012 that would have matched $40 million in private donations already promised for the museum. But Oklahoma City State Senator Kyle Loveless plans for two different bond proposals. One would be for $40 million to match the private money. The other authorizes $32 million with the idea that more donations would help pay for the facility. Loveless says the museum will eventually spur economic development. But Senator Cliff Aldridge, who helped scuttle last year's funding plans, says he'll again oppose any additional state spending on the museum. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
On this day in 1839, nearly 700 Cherokee people arrived in present-day Oklahoma as part of their forced removal from the East. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. This is a court-ordered legal notice for Native Americans. The Cobell Indian Trust Settlement is approved. If you believe you might be included in the settlement, you need to file a claim by March 1, 2013 to get a payment. Information is available at the website indiantrust.com or by calling 1-800-961-6109. That's indiantrust.com or 1-800-961-6109. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Well, Dr. Roberts not in the studio with us, but we do have Dr. Quigley Peterson, who's an emergency physician out at Bartlett Hospital, and we also have Sandy Kelly here, who's the EMS training officer for Capital City Fire and Rescue. And thanks to both you guys for coming in. And we're going to do a fun thing here in just a minute. Both Jeff Brown and myself are going to get a couple of flu shots. That's good. Jeff set that up. Way to go, Jeff.
I'm ready.
He's ready. He's here. He's stoked. He's ready to do it. But I wanted to just quickly talk to you guys a little bit. We'll talk to you about this as we're getting the flu shots and even after as well. But the one big message that you guys are carrying with you today is the changes that have kind of been evolving in how CPR is handled and how emergency situations are handled nationwide. And tell me a little bit about some of the developments happening in CPR.
Yeah, you know, it's not a subject you would typically get excited about, but we're super excited about it because there's a lot of data out there that has shown that early CPR, when people go down for cardiac reasons, can double your chances of surviving. And that's
amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So that's a change.
That's a huge change. But at the same time, what we've just changed in the city or the borough is that when you call 911, and there is a patient who is apparently having a cardiac problem and not breathing, instead of instructing people to do mouth-to-mouth and chest compressions, we're doing chest compression only, CPR, and the outcomes are better.
So just that thing of compressing the chest in a rhythmic way and not then stopping every couple of counts and then doing the mouth-to-mouth and going back and taking the pulse and all that, that has been very simplified.
It's been simplified because it works better.
Because what you're explaining to me is when you're compressing the chest, you're not just compressing the heart and encouraging it to beat in a rhythmic pattern and making that blood flow happen, but you're also compressing the lungs, which is allowing for oxygen to get into.
Well,
is that right?
Great question. When you come off the chest, you are creating a little negative pressure in the chest. And so we're doing 100 compressions in a minute. Every time you come off the chest, a little bit of air gets in there. And a little bit of air is all you want. If you put too much air in and increase pressure inside the chest, you actually reduce blood flow to the heart. So simpler is better.
And Sandy, is this something that professionals are being trained in as well? This is the technique that professionals are using now as well for CPR?
On the professional side, it's pretty much the same, but we still have pulse checks and things like that we do on our side of the house to verify that the patient does need CPR. But staying on the chest is very important to us as well, and that's what we're emphasizing, is worrying about the chest compressions versus not so much about the airway steps that we used to focus on a lot.
And this term that you guys are using using is bystander CPR. Tell me a little bit about what you mean there.
Correct. What the encouragement has been for the last couple of years is to get community involvement and get people to recognize how important bystander CPR is. A lot of folks are afraid and look at the liability side of things, that if I do something wrong, I'm in trouble or I could hurt the patient. So we're really focusing on getting community education for things and having bystander CPR done. When they call 911, our emergency medical dispatchers, they will give the person instructions on how to do CPR for that patient.
Yeah, we've all heard these nightmare scenarios of, oh, you do CPR and you crack a rib and you puncture a lung or all these things that are, you know, the potential bad things. But what the message you're giving is, look, the greatest chance of survival for a person whose heart has stopped is to immediately start giving CPR.
That's correct. And that's why if you call 911 now, the dispatchers are going to ask you, is this person breathing normally? And if they aren't, they're going to tell you to roll them over, put your hands in their chest, and get on it. And just a month ago, a woman watched her husband collapse out in the backyard. Called them, they told her what to do, and he's still with us. So it's in the old days.
Amazing, yeah. Now, is the change the technique? Is that the change in the effectiveness? Or what is it that's made this data change where the effectiveness of CPR is now greater?
A lot of the change for folks is the recognition of they're down, they're not breathing, and starting things quickly instead of looking for a pulse, trying to give people breaths with mouth-to-mouth, which may not be successful, so they continue to try to do those things. And it's also the fact of, for probably about the last 5 to 10 years with American Heart Guideline changes, it was hard and fast compressions. And that's where he's talking about the 100 compressions in a minute with it.
I see. So that's a change. Instead of trying to match some heart rate that was slower, it's hard and fast, and
that's correct, and that's where the error thing comes in. It used to be 60, I think. The previous guidelines were 60 compressions a minute. So 100, again, data-driven, outcomes better.
And it seems much less intimidating from a kind of layman's perspective, like, hey, just get on their chest and compress it 100 times a minute instead of, do it so many times, check, pulse, all that stuff that seems, you know, if you're not a health professional.
Right, and also
confusing.
You're not kissing someone you don't know. I mean, some people don't like that.
Less gross.
And
yes.
It's less difficult for finding, like, landmarks. They just tell the people the center of the chest. You don't have to worry about all these fancy ways, 2 inches here, 2 inches there. Just find the center of the chest and push hard and fast.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about flu shots and get the flu shots. Jeff's standing by to get one. I'm going to get one as well here. I'm going to stand up here and get a flu shot right now. I'm so excited about this. Oh, boy. If you hear a loud thud back out there in the audience, Jeff will take over.
Well, Andy, I've got the 6-inch needle
here.
Okay.
Well, yeah, nice. That's a big one. All right. I'm getting it in my left arm here. He's putting it in my shoulder. Danny Peterson is taking some photos for us, too. And has it already happened? Is that it?
Yet.
Wow. There you go.
You survived.
Hey, that's a doctor right there for you. I didn't even know it had happened.
And does it matter whether I put it in the right arm or the left arm?
It's your call.
Can it get a little sore? Is that one of the things people can know about?
Yeah, it's not unusual for it to be a little sore that evening or the next day, but nothing like a tetanus shot.
Any other symptoms that people can expect if they get a flu shot? A little bit of tiredness, things like that? Or
Typically, no. But this is the time of year where people are getting sick anyway, so there's always that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can remember a couple years ago feeling maybe a little bit tired for maybe 24 hours or so, but then No other symptoms.
He's doing it, Andy.
He's doing it. It's in there. It's not in there yet. Wait for it. I was lying. It already was in there. It had been in there the whole time.
Didn't feel a thing.
Boy, he's brave.
Amazing.
He survived.
He really jabbed you. Man, he got you. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Quigley. That Quigley Peterson there putting it. That's great. Huh? What do you think, Jeff? Your review? That was terrific, man. Well, tell me a little bit, just that while we're on the flu shots, encouraging people to take them. Is there any downside to getting a flu shot?
Well, if you don't get it, you can get influenza and die, but that's fear-based. I think that there's a lot of misinformation about flu shots. The shots we just gave are single dose. They don't have the preservative put in them. The multi-dose vials do, so a lot of people don't want to get it for that reason. So the ones that we have at
the
health...
Can you explain that a little just for folks that aren't aware of what that...
Okay, so medicines often come with 10 doses in a vial. And so in order to go in and out with a needle, even though you use alcohol, you have to put a preservative in there to keep it from getting contaminated. but we just use a small syringe with a single dose, and those have had all that stuff filtered out. So there may be trace amounts, but it's not mercury being injected into you.
Right. Yeah. So it's so the some of the byproducts of that aren't there anymore.
Correct.
Yeah. Anything else about statistically? Does this really 100% prevent getting sick from the flu? Or
no, not at all. It's about 60% effective, but it also that means 60% of the time you won't get the flu if you're exposed. Really hard to come up with those numbers, but it also can attenuate the flu symptoms in people who otherwise would get sicker. And the idea for us in EMS and in healthcare is we don't want to get a mild case and give it to somebody else who can ultimately die as a result of it.
Sure, yeah, and get a really acute case or be otherwise not in premium health and so therefore be more susceptible to symptoms.
One of the bad parts with the flu is when you look at it for the healthcare provider side, we can have the start of the flu and not be showing symptoms, so then we could potentially expose patients without knowing it. So that's why we really encourage our workers and healthcare providers to get their flu vaccine.
I should do that too, I guess. I'm meeting all these people here on the Juno afternoon all the time. I'm so glad I got it. Well, are we getting hit hard with the flu here in Juno? I mean, we're hearing a lot of the national stories about the flu really taking out a lot of people as far as work, you know, and that kind of thing.
Well, just before coming down here, I was at the infection control office at the Bartlett facility, and I saw a graph of recent reports of flu-like illnesses, because you don't influenza is one of many kinds of flu, but that's what we're preventing with the vaccine. And the graph had this acute spike just in the last 2 weeks, and I think that pretty much mirrors what's going on in the most of the country.
What is it about the flu that happens in the winter in these months? Why is that?
The flu, the virus likes certain type of weather conditions, and what happens typically in the winter as far as indoor air temperatures and humidity, it does better in that milieu. It obviously exists in the southern hemisphere in their winter.
Yeah, right.
But it tends to be seasonal. It tends to last 2 to 3 months,
right,
and then that's it.
And then there's this kind of worldwide cycle that goes through of trying to find the new strains, trying to predict what's going to be the big strains this year and all those kinds of things. And that's a whole other area of medicine that's pretty fascinating.
They use supercomputers. The shot you just got has antigens to create immunity against three different strains that have been identified that are out there circulating. And they're pretty good at this.
And supercomputers, like I have microchips in me now?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Going on? That's great.
Yeah.
All right, I feel smarter already. Well, anything else that we want to – the other thing I know that is another interesting part of the emergency techniques that are being developed now is a way of stabilizing people who might have spinal injuries as well. Is that another thing that's kind of been changing?
Well, what we're looking at is in the old days, we would everyone that had what we call a mechanism of injury, like a fall from a height, they were in a vehicle accident, pedestrian versus a car type of situation, all those patients, regardless, we would tend to put them on a hard backboard.
So, and we all know that, like on a basically yes. a hard stretcher and strap them in and yep. kind of stabilize it.
And it can be very uncomfortable for patients. And also if patients are on it for too long, it has its own other set of problems that it could cause for being on a board for too long. So what we're starting to train our individuals on for the department is we call it a vacuum mattress. It has little beads in it. It's the length of a patient, roughly 6 feet long. And we can put a patient on it, draw vacuum. It takes all the air out from around those little beads, and it becomes very hard, kind of like a rigid surface.
So it forms perfectly to the person's
yeah,
body?
Yeah, you can form it to the person, really? Form it up around their neck, their legs, everything. But it is way more comfortable than being on a hard backboard.
And it's more effective at maintaining inline stabilization mm-hmm. because it controls lateral neck motion better, especially on people who have head injuries, who've been drunk, who are fighting you, which is a big, huge problem in EMS. But a bigger issue is the long transport times when people are in small villages or communities in Southeast. They go to Juneau or Ketchikan, then they end up in Seattle. And if you're on one of these things for 10 or 12 hours, you get pressure ulcers, you get oxygen steel. They're not good for the patients. They were designed to get people out of places, not to get people to places.
Right. So this is another development that's sort of helping in this emergency area. It's great to know. Anything else that's been developing in that way that you guys want to emphasize today?
I think the other exciting thing we have that's going on is we use cardiac monitors when we pick up patients, especially ones that we look at that we feel are having a heart attack type of situation. Mm-hmm. We will run 12-lead EKGs on them in the field, and something that I will be working on tomorrow, actually, is we're placing modems on each one of these. We call them LifePak 15s on each one of these models, so that way when we have someone in the field, all our providers have to do is hit a button. It automatically transmits to Bartlett, and this 12-lead prints out at the Bartlett ED. The doc there can go ahead and review it and potentially go ahead and get medical transport lined up to get the person sent to Seattle for further cardiac care.
All right.
So yeah, based on that EKG, we can reserve the airlift jet that's on the ground before the patient even hits the hospital. We can send it to the cardiologist on call in Anchorage or Seattle, and they can look at it on a computer or an iPhone. So it's really using technology to hit that window to get people out of here faster. And again, so we can get better outcomes.
Yeah, I remember the early days of this, calling it telemedicine was the sort of key word that was used. But this is a really practical and inexpensive way to kind of use that technology. Well, thanks so much to both of you, Dr. Quigley-Peterson, emergency physician out of Bartlett, and also Sandy Kelly from EMS, the EMS training officer. Thanks so much to both of you, and thanks for the flu shot. And Jeff, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
All right. Talking to you guys, willing victims.
Yes. Feeling fortified, healthy, hale, got that flu shot in me. And talking next to Tom Loker and Laura Haywood, who are part of the Juno Cabaret. It's happening at the Jack on Sunday. Welcome to both of you. Thanks
Hi,
for coming
Andy.
In.
Thank you, Andy.
Tell me a little bit about the cabaret. This is something you guys have done a number of times and always a fun event.
Yeah, this will be our 12th show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what happens at the cabaret.
Well,
everything we can imagine, all the Liza Minnelli, right? That's what we
Yes, exactly. Our local Liza Minnellis. You got it. And there are more than you might think. There are some really talented singers here in Juneau and accompanists like Tom.
Hey, thank you.
So how many people get in? How many performers are there and
There's
singers and accompanists?
There's usually about 14.
Wow.
Yeah.
Singers or,
yeah,
or combined?
Singers.
Just singers.
Yeah.
And then, Tom, you have to – how many of those do you accompany?
In past cabaret shows, Andy, I've accompanied 5 or 6.
Okay.
And then we have about 6 other volunteer accompanists participating in Juno Cabaret. Some great, great accompanists. One of our main ones is Megan Feltz, who also operates North Star Music Academy, where we get some of our great singers.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What are some of the challenges of, in a performance like that, working with 6 different singers in one... On one stage and one performance.
Well, thankfully, we have Laura, who's organized and, and sets up the playlist so that singers appear with their accompanist, and then the next accompanist comes up and that set of singers. But we rehearse in advance of the show, so it's not as though we're walking in cold.
Sure, yeah.
And
It's a wonderful range of singers. We have some really terrific people who have sung a lot, and you know that most people have heard. But we also have these wonderful new discoveries. Some of them are Megan students. Young. Some of them are in high school and just have these drop-dead gorgeous voices.
Beginners and veterans, but probably one of the more satisfying things for me, and I think for Laura too, is to watch one of those beginning singers get up there, be all nervous at the beginning, and by the end of the song, they're a better singer.
They own it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
That's a great thing.
Have you noticed, over the 12 different performances, have you noticed trends that are happening with maybe younger people or just in general?
Yes. I think when the younger singers get to watch the veterans perform, they pick up on two things. One is that they learn a lot of stylistic and technical things from watching more veteran singers. But probably the most important thing they learn is that they can recover from a mistake. They can recover from something that did not go exactly as planned, and it's still okay. Yeah,
that's actually wow. That's a really good insight. But before you actually get on stage and see how it all works, you probably just think, if I hit a wrong note or if I go wrong or if I forget that one verse, I'm just done.
It's not the end of the world, and it's really not the end of the song, Andy. We always have them finish, and no one starts over.
Yeah.
We recover right in the middle. I have to also extend credit to David Shakely, who's a great local drummer and has performed, I think, at all 11 of the past cabaret shows, or at least 10 of them. So he's great at helping me cover when not everything goes as planned. So,
And as Tom was just saying, you're one of the organizer kind of behind this. Tell me some of the challenges of organizing an event like this. It must be, there's a little bit of a herding cat exercise here?
Not really so much, and I think that's because the accompanists do such a good job of prepping their people. But I think the interest in it for me has been to keep some of this kind of music alive. Usually we do music from the Great American Songbook, and I'm talking about people, songwriters like Johnny Mercer and Cole Porter and Gershwin and all kinds of jazz people and musical theater. And I think some of these young kids come in and they want to instantly do their favorite pop song that they've heard on the radio, and maybe they do that the first time, but they're actually learning about how wonderful some of these older songs are. And you have so much latitude with them. You don't do them just the way you heard them on the radio.
Yeah. So, I'm sure American Idol has had a huge influence on this kind of stuff,
I think you're absolutely right. I think people have woken up to the joy of the human voice. And I think shows like that have really helped.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree with Laura that Juno Cabaret keeps a Great American Songbook very accessible to younger listeners. And they do recognize some of those songs and didn't know they were that old. And then they want to perform them too. We also try and pick arrangements sometimes that breathe new life into these old standards.
And then the other thing that you were, when you were describing, especially younger singers, I was thinking about was stage presence. Do you see that development happen as you're working with them?
Most certainly, yeah. Because they get to watch the other veteran singers and each other, and they get tips and coaching from their accompanists.
And that's so much a part of a cabaret, right, is there has to be a presence there. It's a show.
The whole point of it is that it's an intimate experience, and you're watching the singer sing it live, interpret it their own way, and there's no wrong way to do these songs. And so what they need to do is relax and be themselves, and I think a lot of them have really come a long way in not being completely terrified.
Yes.
Yes, that's a key, right? Don't be terrified. So if people want to go, how do they get tickets?
Well, you can just come to the Jack at 6 p.m., and I want to say make an evening of it. We're going to have food. We always have a bar, and we're going to have Rockwell provide the food. And the last I heard, this is not an absolute commitment, but they're talking about pulled pork sandwiches, which is pretty great. And we're also going to have a bake sale. The Juno Douglas High School kids who are trying to raise money to go to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh are going to sell some of their baked stuff. So I really urge people to come hungry.
Is there a charge to get in?
Pay as you can. Oh. It's all by donation.
Yeah.
Yeah, terrific.
So no advance ticket needed. Just show up at the Jack, the old armory here, at 6 o'clock Sunday, the The 20th. Yes.
The 20th, and enjoy the cabaret. 14 different singers, is that?
I think we have 12 this time.
12? Yeah. 12 different singers with a number of different accompanists, 5 different accompanists?
This time, I think there are 5 of us.
Including David. There's Jackie Farnsworth and Bev Haywood, in addition to Tom and Megan Feltz. So, plus David.
Yeah. So it'll be a great lineup, and we have both men and women singing in Juno Cabaret time. Yeah.
Are there any featured singers you want to just say, hey, you know, if you're a fan of so-and-so, make sure you go?
Dan Wayne will be there. He's a perennial favorite at Juno Lyric Opera.
Yeah, he's an opera singer. This is going to be his debut with Juno Cabaret.
Yeah.
And some of the favorites are people like Bobby Mitchell and
Laura's spouse, John Haywood.
John Haywood. And Clifford Johnson is also a big favorite.
Yeah. Great.
Okay. And others. Great.
So the cabaret, it's happening Sunday night. It's at 6 o'clock. It's at the Jack. It's pay as you can, so just show up. There'll also be a bake sale. It's benefiting the kids who are getting together money to go to the Fringe Festival in Scotland.
Right. And although there's a bar at the Juno Cabaret, we always have a seating area for the under 21. So they're welcome, too.
Great. So it's an all-ages event.
That's right.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much, Tom and Laura.
Thanks for having us here, Andy.
At the cabaret on Sunday night at the Jack at 6 o'clock.
Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 16th of January, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet who wrote the lines, "Were you ever out in the great alone when the moon was awful clear and the icy mountains hemmed you in with the silence you most could hear, with only the howl of a timber wolf and you camped there in the cold, a half-dead thing in a stark dead world, clean mad for the muck called gold?" The Canadian poet Robert Service, born in Preston, England, 1874, he was working for the Canadian Bank of Commerce in the Yukon Territory when he wrote that and his other famous poems of the Yukon. It was on this date in 1605, Book One of Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes was published, about the middle-aged landowner from a village in La Mancha, stays awake at night reading books about chivalry, forgets to eat and sleep, believes the stories are true, and sets off on his skinny horse in a heroic quest to resurrect old-fashioned chivalry and heroism in the modern world. It's the birthday of the poet and memoirist Mary Carr, born in Groves, Texas, 1955, had a rough childhood, grew up in a small town, alcoholic parents, her mother mentally ill. Mary Carr, author of 4 books of poetry and also best-selling memoirs, The Liar's Club in 1995, and 2 more, Cherry and Lit. Mary Carr, who said, "Memoir is not an act of history, but an act of memory, which is innately corrupt." And it's the birthday of the food writer Ruth Reichel, born in New York City, 1948, whose mother loved to cook but was terrible at it. Ruth Reichel remembered, "My mother really would make these dreadful concoctions. She really prided herself on something called everything stew, where she would take everything in the refrigerator, all the leftovers, and put them all together. One day I was watching her put in leftover turkey and broccoli and a little can of mushroom soup, and she's throwing things in, and half an apple pie goes in. In defense, I started cooking because I didn't want to eat that." Ruth Reichel, who became a great cook, a restaurant critic, and for 10 years the editor of Gourmet magazine. Here's a poem for today by Leo Dangle, entitled "His Elderly Father as a Young Man." "This happened before I met your mother. I took Jenny Johansson to a summer dance, and she sent me a letter, a love letter, I guess, even if the word love wasn't in it. She wrote that she had a good time and didn't want the night to end. At home she lay down on her bed, but stayed awake, listening to the songs of morning birds outside her window. I read that letter 100 times and kept it in a cigar box with useless things I had saved, a pocket knife with an imitation pearl handle and a broken blade, a harmonica I never learned to play, one cufflink, an empty rifle shell. When your mother and I got married, I threw the letter away. If I had kept it, she might wonder. But I wanted to keep it, and even thought about hiding places, maybe in the barn or the tool shed. But what if it were ever found? I knew of no way to explain why I would keep such a letter, much less why I would take the trouble to hide it. A poem by Leo Dangle, his elderly father as a young man, from Home from the Field, published by Spoon River Poetry Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well. Do good work and keep in touch.
Programming support comes from Bee's Bakery and Bistro, offering homemade baked goods, lunch items, and paninis Tuesday through Friday from 7:30 to 5:30 and weekends from 9 a.m. to 3. Bee's Bakery and Bistro, located downtown on 2nd Street.
Ocean Man.
The Ocean Men. They're over at NOAA, those Ocean Men. And we've got a couple of folks from NOAA right now. Julie Spiegel and Glenn Merrill are with me in the studio. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. And you guys are implementing or have... There's some rule changes that have happened with the Observer program that happens on commercial fishing vessels, and you guys are doing some outreach about that. So tell me, Julie, a little bit about some of the changes that have happened here on the Observer program.
Right,
and what NOAA's responsibilities are there.
Thank you for having us on the show, Andy. January 1st, our new Federal Fisheries Observer Program went into effect, and there have been some changes, especially for smaller vessel owners. And there's a lot of questions surrounding that. People want to know exactly what they should expect. And so we've been holding a series of outreach meetings around the state. Tomorrow, there's an outreach meeting here in Juneau at Centennial Hall. It begins at 9 a.m. And we're here to tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so that outreach is for people in the industry, like trying to understand what observers are going to be looking at, what some of the rule changes are.
Right. So, Andy, I guess the main difference in this program versus our old program is that it improves a lot of the ways that we collect samples and we deploy observers on board vessels, primarily on the smaller boat fleet. And it expands the program to small boat operators that previously hadn't had observers. And here in Southeast Alaska, I think the primary constituents that we're concerned with are participants in the halibut fishery and some of the smaller participants in other federally managed fisheries. The program doesn't affect folks in the state salmon fisheries or state managed fisheries, but it does affect folks who are involved in those federally managed fisheries.
So in the past, the halibut, like someone running a small halibut boat, didn't have observers on board? That just didn't enter into it?
That's correct.
And so now they will occasionally, or how is that implemented?
They will occasionally, and that depends on a couple of things. And the way that this program works right now is that vessel operators that are under 40 feet don't have an observer at all. They won't be subject to those coverage levels. That could occur at some point in the future, but we think that's pretty unlikely right now because we don't anticipate a great need for the data from those smaller boat operators, just given the size of those vessels and the amount of catch that they have. But for those vessels that are in that 40 feet up to 57 and a half feet, which is right below the limit saner level of 58 feet, common in a lot of Southeast Alaska fisheries, they will have an opportunity to have observers. They can be selected. It's a random selection process that we have. We select on these two-month periods. Anytime they're going out for a trip, they would have an observer. There's about a 1 in 10 or so chance that a vessel might be selected for an observer if they're in that size category.
So an observer, what is typically an observer doing on these boats? What kind of data are they collecting, and how do they do that?
So So I actually got started about 22 years ago as an observer out in the Bering Sea. It was a little different experience out there, obviously. But your basic task is the same, which is you're on board the vessels, you're collecting biological samples, you're seeing about the species composition of the catch that's coming on board the vessel, you're sampling that, you're looking at what fish are discarded, you're trying to gain some weights from that. You might take tissue samples from the various fish that are coming on board the vessel. All of that information then feeds into our what we call our stock assessment process. This helps us better understand what is the allowable catch that we can provide to fishermen on an annual basis, make sure that we're monitoring accurately the health of the resource.
And the reason that the program was expanded, is it that it was felt that a little bit too much fishing might have been happening at these lower fishery sizes? I mean, the lower vessel sizes, it was enough smaller vessels that it might be impacting these different stocks. Is that the idea?
So there's a couple of things that I think the program does that's good. One is it addresses a potential bias issue, which is we don't necessarily know how people are fishing and what kind of catch might come on board on some of these smaller vessels. That could be very useful information for us as managers. The second aspect of the program is under the way the program worked previously, some of the vessel owners would be able to select when they took their observers. And this can create kind of a bias problem. Obviously, they might take out observers for certain trips when they know they might go to certain areas where they have, say, low bycatch or incidental catch of other species. That can affect our estimates. That affects our ability to accurately determine the health of the resource. And so part of the program is this random deployment method that we think will really help get us less biased data that'll be more useful for us as managers.
Yeah, like, I mean, basic science stuff, which is you try to get stuff that's not biased. You try to, you know, get the truth, right? Get what's really happening out there. Try to collect the stuff as accurately as possible. So that makes plenty of sense.
Right.
And are there – so you mentioned halibut. Is that the main thing here in Southeast, especially halibut fishery is really the one? Are there other species of concern or other species that you guys are particularly looking for? Maybe that's an incidental catch or that kind of thing.
So I think that's what we'll learn from this observer program. Having deployment on some of these halibut vessels in particular, I think, will be important for us to gain some new information. Here in Southeast, the main fisheries are the halibut and the sablefish, IFQ fisheries, incidental. Then we'll also have a little bit of extra coverage on the Pacific cod fishery. There are some vessels that are also engaged in that, a little bit in some of the rockfish fisheries as well. But for the most part here in Southeast Alaska, it is that halibut and sablefish IFQ fishery.
Yeah. What happens at these meetings when you're talking to industry and stuff? You're going to have one coming up tomorrow, right, at Centennial Hall?
Right. So we've had about a dozen or so of these outreach meetings so far. We've also been very engaged with the public on our website, which is at www.alaskafisheries.noaa.gov. So if you want to know more about the program, you can go there as well.
I'm on there right now. I'm looking at the frequently asked questions.
Perfect.
In fact, all the questions I've asked are just right off of the website. No, but really, really comprehensive site here. You've got a bunch of information on here. So yeah, that's a great resource.
Great. So then these meetings in particular are an opportunity for vessel owners and operators to have that face-to-face interaction with us, ask questions about how the program works, how do I register for observer coverage, what does an observer do when they're on board my vessel, what obligations do I have, all of those kinds of questions. And I think that they've been really useful for the public to get a better understanding of the program. They're also very helpful for us because we hear back concerns that they may have about the program, other things that we can do in the future to hopefully improve the program so that we're getting the data we need and we're not imposing too much of a burden on the vessel operators when they have these observers.
Did people see it coming? Did they know this was happening so it's not a huge surprise? And so you're just explaining this program that's kind of been coming for a while?
Right. This program has been many years in the development and was developed through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council process with a lot of public input. So it's taken quite a while to develop it, and we're finally putting it in place. And we encourage people to come out tomorrow. There's a lot of information on blogs out there that's not exactly correct, and we'd like to get the right information out there. So we certainly encourage people to come to the meeting tomorrow, and to if you can't make it to the meeting, visit our website. There are some helpful phone numbers on there as well.
You say this is kind of something that's been developing for a while. Was this heated? Was this you know, fairly controversial, or is it something that's been working for so long that it's, you know, to a point? Or you know, give me just a little bit of a flavor of what that kind of how that's developed.
Sure. So the program was developed through the North Pacific Fishery Management mm-hmm. Council, and they have a primary responsibility of providing policy guidance to us at NOAA in terms of how we manage our fisheries. And I think the council has always been very interested in and an advocate for improving our data quality. The program itself, when it was finally adopted by the council, was back in 2010. That was unanimous. They continue to unanimously support the program. There has been some controversy with the program, and I think a lot of this is similar to the controversy you have when any new program comes in place. A lot of these vessel owners and operators haven't ever had observers before. They're not familiar with having somebody on board their vessel who's maybe not a crew member. They don't know how necessarily they might accommodate that additional body on board the vessel. And so I think that there's been a lot of concern just about that. I think overall there hasn't been so much controversy in the goals of the program, but it's just that aspect of what does it mean to have an additional person on board my vessel? How is that going to affect my operations and getting familiar with that program as well? So we're trying to do everything we can through our outreach meetings, working with the public as well, working with various stakeholder groups to let them know what all of that entails, which is why these outreach meetings are so important and why we're going to be continuing these probably throughout the year as well as we learn more about the program and hear more from the affected public about how this affects them.
Is there a date when this program is implemented? Is it implemented now already or is it –
It's implemented.
Okay, so there's observers going out now right. that to boats that haven't had them before, and that's in the process of happening right now.
Yes,
right. We have, I think, about 9 vessels with observers on board.
So, folks who want to find out more about this, tell us just about the meeting itself and the next opportunity here in Juneau.
The meeting will be held tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. at Centennial Hall. And if you cannot make the meeting, please visit our website, alaskafisheries.noaa.gov. There's a lot of helpful information, frequently asked questions, as Andy mentioned, and helpful phone numbers.
All right. Well, Julie Spiegel and Glenn Merrill, both from NOAA, thanks so much for coming in, explaining this program, and good luck with that meeting tomorrow and all the upcoming meetings and implementing this program.
Great. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks so much.
Did you know that Alaska possesses 90% of the estimated potential tidal power in the entire United States? Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to making Alaska a world leader in clean, renewable energy. Find out more on the web at realaska.org. This message brought to you by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
Do you still sing of the mountain bed we made a limb?
The mountain song there, little Billy Bragg and Wilco, and we're here with Eagle Crest folks. Jeffra and Matt are with me in the studio. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Good. When we were walking in here, I said, oh, how about this rain? And you're like, rain? Man, snowing up on the mountain. Are you kidding me?
That
so
it is.
Tell us let's get that out of the way. Current conditions as you see them right now, what's
sure.
happening up on the mountain?
So the update as of this morning from people that were up there both at the base and the summit is 16 inches of snow at the summit
and 6 at the base as of this morning, and snowing hard all day. It's very wet snow, as you can tell down here. We've had close to 4 inches of rain equivalent, but snow is still snow. And there's a little bit of, there was a crust at the bottom, but we're hoping today's snow and tonight's snow kind of buries that crust. So we're thinking it's not going to be blower powder tomorrow, but it's going to be powder.
Yeah, it'll be and all fresh and untracked, right?
Exactly.
A couple of days off up the mountain there. So that's great to know. And tell me about, do you have data in on attendance and stuff like that, and people who have been up at the mountain? Has it been going good this year?
Yeah, it's been going pretty well. It's not as big as it was last year as far as people buying lift tickets and what have you. So we're certainly trailing last year, but it's still been a very positive year. And the big thing this year is we've had another huge year for season's pass sales, which really helped us out. It's
great.
A huge chunk of our revenue, and it's another record this year over last year. So we're hoping we're kind of setting a new normal for what our passes are going to bring in. It's a fantastic thing to see. I think we're getting out early and getting out often, and people are committing to Eagle Crest for the winter. So we'd love to see that.
And you guys are in the midst of Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month here, January. Lots of new people up on the mountain?
Yeah, there have been, Andy. And I think that's also the big thing that we're seeing, is we are seeing more new to the mountain people. People coming up deciding this is the year to learn how to ski and snowboard. And that's great for us. I know over the weekend we had two big families who all of the families decided, hey, we're going to learn how to ski and ski this weekend as a family. And I asked them, why? Why now? Why
right,
today?
Why?
And they said, hey, we've just been talking about it. We've been hearing it about it. And we decided this is what we want to do. So and that's good. We're getting the word out about this is the year to try to learn how to ski or snowboard. And we know you'll be happy if you do.
That's right. You don't see frowns up there.
No, never.
Maybe just after the first little fall. Then you get back up and you're smiling again. It's all fun after that. Well, what other programs going on at the mountain right now?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of big programs that are coming up as part of our Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month. One of the big ones happens at the end of the month. That's our 32nd annual Learn to Ski Weekend. And that's for 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders who have never skied before. And the applications are in the schools now. You can also find information on our website at skijuno.com. And the applications have to be turned in to us by 2 o'clock on Tuesday the 22nd. So that's why I wanted to really get that word out today.
Okay.
And again, that's for kids who have never skied before. This is a great weekend sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Subaru. It includes free lessons, lift tickets, transportation, food, rentals. It's just an amazing weekend for 45 very lucky kids.
Great, but just one more week available to that until next Tuesday is when the applications have to be turned in by.
Correct.
Okay.
And you can find information on skijuno.com, or all the elementary schools have the applications in the schools. And so again, we just encourage everyone to submit an application. It's a random drawing, and we choose 45 lucky kids who get to come up for the weekend. And it's, I have to tell you, Andy, I think it's one of my favorite weekends of the year.
Right, yeah, because everyone's a winner.
Everyone's a winner. It's
you know?
It's great fun.
45 winners up there. That's great stuff. Everyone won the lottery. So that's good. Anything else? What else? You mentioned there's a couple of new things.
Yep, and then also on Sunday is, as again, part of our Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month, is Learn to Adapt Day. And adaptive Ski and Snowboard Awareness Day. We offer free lessons, information on adaptive skiing and snowboarding. If you have a friend or a family member who could benefit by some adaptive skiing or snowboarding, or you just want to find out what it's all about. Let's say, Andy, you decide you want to come up and you've always wanted to monoski. Hey, you can take a half-hour monoski.
What, just one ski?
There it is. There's a picture for you.
There you go. So what's the difference between monoskiing?
It's a sit ski.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see. Very cool.
It allows people who are not able to walk in a wheelchair to actually experience the fun and the passion of skiing that
we
have.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yes.
Very cool.
So that's what we've paired up with SAIL, and we're going to have instruction out there. You can explore it, find out a little bit more about it, look at the equipment, even try out the equipment. And I think a lot of folks don't realize we do have a strong partnership with SAIL. We have about 8 instructors on staff who have at least some level of PSIA certification in adaptive skiing. And we work really closely with SAIL just to work on our training and make sure that Eagle Crest is accessible to everybody.
So cool. SAIL is such a great organization, you know, just making life accessible to people who otherwise it might not be. And it's really cool to know Eagle Crest is working with them.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And, you know, there's the ORCA program every weekend. And so we just want to come up. So if you're interested, come up on Sunday. You just have to have a lift ticket. But, again, some free lessons. Get out and try the equipment. Find out all about what's going on.
Yeah, cool. Tell me about the terrain park.
Yeah, so we got that open last weekend, and we got our Alaska Marine Lions boxes up, and lots of kids and adults were getting out and getting after it. So it was great to see, and we're hoping we wanted to get through this stretch of weather because it was potentially coming in much warmer than it did and see where we end up. But with this snow now, and we'll take a look at adding some more features as the weeks go along. But for now, we got there's three boxes up, and lots of people are getting after it and hitting it. So it's been a great first weekend.
What's the plan on kind of adding features? What are the other things that you guys might look at?
Well, we're definitely gonna be adding a jump or two as well in there, of varying sizes, and then also just look at other kind of cool features. You know, whether it's a big old tractor tire or something cool like that. We're trying to come up with something that's uniquely Southeast Alaska. So we've thrown ideas like some sort of crab pot rail or something like that. But
I don't know about that one.
Yeah. There's actually a nationwide contest within ski areas to come up with creative terrain park features.
You know someone's going
to
get caught in there if you put a crab pot
on it. Maybe it'll just be a Lund-type boat or something.
Yeah,
but
well,
who
that's
knows?
Good. Yeah. I have to ride the rail, the underside of a skiff. I could definitely see that one. That
right.
would work. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll come up with we're gonna get creative, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, very cool. Any other stuff happening as far as the other areas of the mountain that where there's interesting things happening or maybe closures or things like that?
No, I mean, at this point, you know, the mountain with good visibility is entirely open. So, you know, like I said, all this new snow should be great, and we're looking forward to getting out there. So it's still, you know, it's not a banner year for snow, but the conditions have been quite good, and we're hoping to be able to start see some visibility-wise and get out into the ridges and the bowls. But people who have been venturing out have had a great time.
Yeah, I mean, the past few years we've gotten so spoiled with so much snow load coming in and just packing in all the, you know, just making everything fluffy and nice and wonderful, right? And so you're having to deal with more hazards probably out there than there have been in years past, especially if you get in the outside areas, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. And there's, you know, those natural, you know, some people love them. A lot of snow changes the mountain, actually takes a lot of those fun little features out of it. So in a year like this, I've been talking to a lot of people that say, you know, that you couldn't ski last year like you can now because there's just more little drops and fun little things to play around on. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you have just feet and feet and feet of snow, those things go away and get buried. So it's its own challenge and its own set of fun. And we're just happy that, you know, this storm came in snowy and hoping it continues.
Right. Okay, so Eagle Crest back open tomorrow, 9 o'clock?
9 o'clock, yeah.
And,
9 to 3:30.
3:30, and the hours might start expanding in the next few weeks. Is that right, as daylight kind of expands?
Yeah, so this weekend is, again, the lower mount lifts are 3:30 and Ptarmigan and Black Bear are 3, but the weekend after next, they'll go to 3:30 all lifts. And then again, in early February, it'll shift to 4 in the lower mount lifts. So we're starting to see more daylight, and we'll keep continuing to push hours back as it happens.
Yeah, all right, all right. Well, everyone, it's your local ski area. It's Eagle Crest, the best little mountain in the world. And Jeff and Matt, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know what's happening up there.
Thanks for having us, Andy.
Thank you.
Do you still sing of the mountain bed we made of limbs and leaves? Do you still sigh there near the sky where the holly berry bleeds? You laughed as I covered you over with leaves, fist, breast, hips, and thighs.
That's it for a Juno afternoon today, an uneventful Juno afternoon where I feel healthier because I got my flu shot. And thanks so much to Dr. Quigley Peterson for giving me the flu shot. And thanks to Sandy Kelly, the EMS training officer, letting us know about the changing face of CPR and emergency medical services. And just that idea that CPR now is much more about the rapid chest compressions and not as much about doing the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Juno Cabaret folks, Laura Haywood and Tom Loker, thanks so much for coming in as well. That's happening Sunday at 6 o'clock at the Jack. It's pay as you can. Just go to the Jack and you can go to the cabaret. The NOAA Observer Program, that was Julie Spiegel and Glenn Merrill from NOAA. Thank you for coming in as well. Their meeting is happening tomorrow at 9 a.m. at Centennial Hall at the Hickel Room in Centennial Hall. You can head there if you're person that runs a boat, is a crew member of a boat, or is interested in that part of the industry, you can find out about the expanding Observer program. And thanks again to Jeffrey and Matt from Eagle Crest for letting us know what's happening up there. Programming note for KTOO, Governor Parnell's State of the State speech is at 7 o'clock tonight, live right here on KTOO, and will be covered by the KTOO newsroom. Forecast for tonight is for areas of fog and rain, heavy at times. Rain will mix with snow at times tonight. There will be little or no snow accumulation and lows around 34 degrees. Rain is in the forecast for tomorrow with highs around 38 degrees and gusts of wind to 30 miles per hour in the morning tomorrow. For tomorrow night, mostly cloudy skies, scattered rain and snow showers, lows around 30 degrees. And for Friday, mostly cloudy, scattered snow and rain showers once again, highs around 33. Friday night, once again, mostly cloudy skies, isolated rain and snow showers, and lows 23 to 31 degrees. But as they were just saying, as Matt and Jeff were just saying, that's all snow up on Eagle Crest. So next few days, have fun in the new snow that continues to come down up on Eagle Crest. Thanks for listening today. I'm Andy Klein, and that's a Juno Afternoon.
As proud as we toss their heads in the wind and blow its seeds away. The sun was hot and the sun was bright down in the valley below.
This is our first task as a society, keeping our children safe. This is how we will be judged.
President Obama calls on Congress for a new ban on assault weapons.